dress is pretty, said Sara softly. And your hair is so soft and yellow. She sighed. I wish I was as beautiful as you are. I wish I had a lovely white skin like you. And I wish I had a beautiful golden skin like yours, Vicky countered swiftly, and they laughed together. Are you dressed like that for Gareth? He would love you very much when he sees you. Let us go and find him. I got a better idea, Sara. Why don't you go and find Gregorius? I'm sure he's looking for you. Sara thought about that for a moment, torn between duty and pleasure. Are you certain you'd be all right on your own, Miss Camberwell? Oh, I think so. Thank you, Sara. If I get into trouble, I'll call you. I'll come right away, Sara assured her. Vicky knew exactly where she'd find Jake Barton, and she came up silently beside the tall steel hull and watched for a while as he worked, completely absorbed and totally oblivious of her presence. She wondered how she'd been so blind as not to have seen him properly before, not to have seen beneath the boyish freshness the strength and quiet assurance of a full, mature man. It was an ageless face, and she knew that even when he was an old man, the illusion of youth and freshness would remain with him. There was an intensity in the eyes, a steely purpose in the heavy line of the jaw that she'd never noticed before. She remembered the dream of his that he told her, the factory building, his own engine, and in a clairvoyant flash, she knew that he had the determination and the strength to make it become a reality. Suddenly she longed to share it with him, and knew that their two dreams could be placed together, his engine and her book. They could be created together, each gathering strength from the other, pooling their determination and their creative reserves. She thought it'd be worthwhile to share both dreams with a man like Jake Barton. Perhaps being in love allows one to see more clearly, she thought, as she watched him with secret pleasure. Or perhaps it simply makes it easy to kid yourself. And she felt annoyance that her natural cynicism should overtake her now. No, she decided. It's not make-believe. He's strong and good, and he'll stay that way. And immediately she thought that perhaps she was trying too hard to convince herself. Unbidden, the memory of the night she'd spent so recently with another man flooded back to her, and for a moment she found herself confused and uncertain. She tried to thrust the memory firmly aside, but it nagged at her, and she found herself comparing two men, remembering the wanton and wicked delights she'd known, and doubting wistfully that she might ever recapture them. Then she looked closer at the man she thought she loved, and saw that although his arms were thick and dark with hair, and his hands were large and heavy-knuckled, yet the thick, spatulate fingers worked with an almost sensuous skill and lightness, and she tried to imagine them moving on her skin, and the image was so clear and voluptuous that she shuddered and drew in her breath sharply. Immediately Jake looked up at her, the surprise in his eyes changing instantly to pleasure, and that slow, warm smile spreading over his face as he ran his eyes swiftly from the top of her silken head down to the silken ankles. "Hello. Haven't I met you somewhere before?" he asked, and she laughed and pirouetted, flaring the dress. "Do you like it?" she asked. He nodded silently and then asked, "Are we going somewhere special?" "The Rass's feast, didn't you know?" I'm not sure I can stand another of his feasts. I don't know which is more dangerous, an Italian attack of that liquid dynamite he serves. You'll have to be there. You're one of the heroes of the great victory. Jake grunted and returned his attention to Priscilla the pig's internal processes. Have you found the trouble? No, Jake sighed with resignation. I've taken her to pieces and put her together again, and I can't find a thing. He stood back, shaking his head and wiping his greasy hands on a wad of cotton waste. I don't know. I just don't know. Have you tried starting her again? No point in that. Not until I find and cure the trouble. Try, said Vicky. And he grinned at her. It's no use. But to humor you? He stooped to the crank handle, and Priscilla fired at the first swing, caught and ran smoothly, purring like a great humpbacked cat in front of the fire.
My God!
Jake stepped back and stared in amazement.
There's just no logic to it.
She's a lady, Vicky explained. You know that. And there isn't necessarily logic in the way a lady behaves. He turned to face her directly and grinned at her, such a knowing expression in his eyes that she felt herself flushing.
I'm beginning to find that out, he said, and stepped towards her.
But she raised both hands protectively.
You put grease on this dress.
If I were to bath first.
Bath, she ordered. And then we'll talk again, mister.
In the last few minutes of daylight, a rider had come down the gorge, clattering and sliding on the rough footing, and then hitting the level ground and galloping into the Rouse's camp on a blown and lathered horse. Sara Sagud took the message he carried, came flying up to the cluster of tents under the flat-topped camel thorn trees, and burst into Vicky Campbell's tent, waving the folded cablegram, without dreaming of announcing her entrance. Vicky was deep in a bear-like enfolding embrace into which Jake Barton had taken her moments before, and the interruption came just as Vicky was abandoning herself to the pleasure of the moment. Jake towered over her, freshly scrubbed and smelling of carbolic soap, with his hair still wet and newly combed. Vicky broke out of his arms and turned furiously to the girl.
"Oh!"
exclaimed Sara, with the natural interest and fascination of a born conspirator discovering a fresh intrigue.
"You are busy."
"Yes, I am,"
snapped Vicky, cheeks aflame with embarrassment and confusion.
"I'm sorry, Miss Camberwell, but I thought this message must be important."
And Vicky's irritation faded as she saw the cablegram.
"I thought you would want it."
Vicky snatched it from her, broke the seal and read avidly. Her anger faded as she read, and she looked up with shining eyes at Sara.
"You're right. Thank you, my dear."
And she spun back to Jake, dancing up to him and flinging both arms around his neck, laughing and gay.
"Hey!"
Jake laughed with her, holding her awkwardly in front of the girl.
"What's this all about?"
"It's from my editor,"
she told him.
My story about the attack at the Wells was an international scoop. Headlines around the world. And there's to be an emergency session of the League of Nations."
Sara snatched the cable back from her and read it, as though by right.
"This is what my father believed that you would do for us, Miss Camberwell, for our land and our people."
Sara was weeping, fat, oily tears breaking from the dark gazelle eyes and clinging in her long lashes.
"Now the world knows. Now they will come to save us from the tyranny."
The girl's faith in the triumph of good over evil was childlike, and she pulled Vicky from Jake's arms and embraced her in his stead.
"Oh, you have given us a chance again. We will always be grateful to you."
Her tears smeared Vicky's cheek, and she drew back, sniffing wetly, and wiped her own tears from Vicky's face with the palm of her hand.
"We will never forget you,"
she said, and then smiled through the tears.
"We must go and tell my grandfather."
They found it impossible to convey to the Rouse the exact nature of this new advancement of the Ethiopian cause. He was very hazy in his exact understanding of the role and importance of the League of Nations, or the power and influence of the international press. After the first few pints of Tej, he had made sure, in his own mind, that in some miraculous fashion the great Queen of England had espoused their cause, and that the armies of Great Britain would soon join him in the field. Both Gregorius and Sara spoke to him at great length, trying to explain his error, and he nodded and grinned benevolently at them, but remained completely unshaken in his conviction, and ended by embracing Gareth Squales, making a long, rambling speech in Amharic, hailing him as an Englishman and a comrade in arms. Then, before the speech ended, the Rouse fell suddenly and dramatically asleep in mid-sentence, falling face forward into a large bowl of mutton wat. The day's battle, the excitement of learning his new and powerful ally, and the large quantities of Tej were too much for him, and four of his bodyguard lifted him from the bowl and carried him snoring loudly to his household tent. Do not worry, Sara told his guests. My grandfather will not be gone for long. After a small rest, he will return.
Tell him not to pull himself out, murmured Gareth Swells. I, for one, have seen about enough of him for one day.
The glow of the bonfires turned the sky ruddy and paled the moon that sailed above the mountain peaks. It shone on the steel and polished wood of the huge pile of captured weapons, rifles and pistols and ammunition bandoliers, that were heaped triumphantly in the open space before the royal party. The sparks from the fires rose straight upwards into the still night, and the laughter and voices of the guests became more unrestrained as the Tedge gourds circulated. Further along the valley, also within the acacia grove, the Gallus of Ras Kula were celebrating the victory also, and there was the occasional faint outburst of drunken shouts and a fusillade of shots from captured Italian rifles. Vicky sat between Gareth and Jake. She had not arranged it so, and if given the choice, would have sat alone with Jake, but Gareth Swells had not been as easily discouraged as she had believed he might. Sara came from her place beside Gregorius. Crossing the squatting circle of feasting guests, she knelt on the pile of leather cushions beside Vicky, pushing herself in between Gareth and the girl, and she leaned close to Vicky, an arm around her shoulder and her lips touching her ears.
You should have told me, she accused her sadly. I did not know that you had decided on Jake first. I would have advised you.
At that instant, a sound carried from the camp of the Gallus to where they sat. It was muted by distance and almost obscured by the closer hubbub of the feasting Harari, yet the terrible heart-stopping quality of it pierced Vicky, so that she gasped and clutched Sara's wrist. Beside her, Jake and Gareth had stiffened and were listening also, their heads turned to catch the sound that rose and died in a long-drawn-out, rending sob.
You have not handled them correctly, Miss Camberwell, Sara went on speaking, as if she'd heard nothing.
Sara, what is that? What was that? Vicky shook her arm urgently.
Ah.
Sara made a gesture of disdain and contempt. That fat pervert, Ras Kula, has come down from his hiding place. Now that we have won the victory, he's come to enjoy the booty. He arrived an hour ago with his fat milch cows, and now he feasts and entertains himself. The sound came again. It was inhuman, a terrible high-pitched screech that tore across Vicky's nerves. It rose higher and higher until Vicky wanted to cover her ears with both hands. At that instant, that it seemed her nerves must snap, the sound was cut off abruptly. A listening silence had fallen upon the reveling throng around the bonfires, and the silence persisted for a few seconds longer after the scream had ended, and there was a murmur of comment, and here and there a burst of careless, cruel laughter.
What is it, damn it, Sara? What are they doing?
Ras Kula is playing with the Italians, Sara said quietly.
Vicky realized that she thought no further of the prisoners taken that day from the routed Italian column.
Playing, Sara? What do you mean?
And Sara spat like an angry cat, a gesture of utter disgust.
They're animals, those beasts of Ras Kula. They will make sport of them all night, and in the morning they will cut away their men's things.
She spat again.
Before they can marry, they must take a man's things. What do you call them? The two things in the little sack?
Testicles, said Vicky hoarsely, almost choking on the word.
Yes, agreed Sara. They must kill a man and take his testicles to the bride. It is their custom, but first they will make sport with the Italians.
Can we stop them?
Vicky asked.
Stop them?
Sara looked amazed.
They are only Italians, and it is the Gala custom.
Again came that cry, and again there was complete silence from the revellers. It climbed high into the silent desert air, shriek upon shriek, so that it seemed impossible that it could come from a human lung, and their souls cringed at the dimensions of suffering which would give vent to that pinnacle of agonized sound.
Oh, God! Oh, God!
whispered Vicky. And she lifted her eyes from Sara's face to that of Gareth Swales, who sat beyond her. He was silent and still, his face turned away from her, so that she saw the godlike profile, perfect and cold. As the cry of agony died away, she leaned forward, took a burning twig from the fire, and lit the long black cheroot between his white teeth. He drew deeply and held the smoke, then let it trickle out through his nostrils. Then he turned deliberately to Vicky. "You heard what the lady said?" "It's the custom," he spoke to Vicky. But the remark was addressed to Jake Barton, and his eyes flicked mockingly to him, a half-smile on his lips. The two men held each other's eyes, unblinking and expressionless. The cry of agony came again, but this time weaker, the aching, ringing tone reduced to a sobbing echo on the dark night. Jake Barton rose to his feet, coming erect with one fluid movement, and in a continuation of the same movement, he crossed to the piles of captured Italian weapons. He stooped, picked up an officer's automatic pistol, a 7mm Beretta, still in its polished leather holster, and he unbuckled the flap and drew the weapon, discarding the leather holster and waist belt. He checked the loaded magazine, and then, with a slap of his palm, thrust it back into the recessed butt, pumped the slide to throw a round into the breech, flicked the safety catch across, and slipped the pistol into the pocket of his breeches. Without looking again at any of the others, he strode away, disappearing beyond the firelight into the darkness, in the direction of the Galler encampment. "I told him a long time ago that sentimentality is an old-fashioned luxury, an expensive one at his age, and especially in this place," murmured Gareth, and inspected the ash of his cheroot.
"They will kill him if he goes in there alone," said Sara, in a completely matter-of-fact tone. "They will be hungry for more blood, and they'll kill him."
"Oh, I don't know if it's as bad as that," Gareth demurred.
"Oh, yes, they'll kill him," said Sara, and turned back to Vicky. "Are you going to let him go?" "They are only Italians," she pointed out.
For a moment, the two women stared at each other, and then Vicky leapt to her feet and went after Jake, the blue linen swirling gracefully around her legs, and the firelight playing like liquid bronze gold on the hair as she ran. She caught up with Jake at the perimeter of the Galler encampment, and she fell in beside him, taking two quick steps to each of his strides. "Go back," he said softly. But she didn't reply and skipped to keep up with him. "Do what I say."
"No, I'm coming with you."
He stopped and swung to face her, and she lifted her chin defiantly, throwing back her shoulders and drawing herself up to her full height so that she came to his shoulder. "Listen to me," he began, and then stopped. As the tortured being cried again in the night, it was a blubbering, incoherent sound, half moan, half sob, followed almost immediately by the throaty roar of many hundred voices, the blood roar of a hunting pack, deep and savage. "That's what it'll be like." His head was turned away from her to listen, and his eyes were haunted.
"I'm coming," she said stubbornly.
And he didn't reply, but broke away and hurried forward towards the glowing reflection of the Galler fires, which turned the branches of the camel thorns to high cathedral roofs of ruddy light over the encampment. There were no sentries posted, and they passed unnoticed through the horse lines and the hastily thatched tukuls and leather tents, coming suddenly into the centre of the camp, where the fires were burning and the Gallers were assembled. A huge dark circle of squatting figures. The firelight bronzed their eager hawk features, and the whole assembly hummed with the charged tension that always holds the spectators at a blood spectacle. Jake remembered it from a prize fight in Madison Square Garden and again from a cockfight in Havana. The bloodlust was running high, and they growled like an animal pack.
"That is the Rascula,"
whispered Vicky, tugging at Jake's sleeve, and he glanced across the open arena of beaten earth. Kula sat on a pile of carpets and cushions, a silk shawl striped in a dozen brilliant colours, was draped across his head and shoulders, masking his smooth, soft face with shadow. But the firelight caught his eyes and made them glitter with a peculiarly feverish fury. One of his fat, ivory-coloured hands was clenched in his lap, while his other arm was cast around the waist of the woman who sat beside him, and his hand kneaded and worked her yielding flesh. The hand seemed to have life of its own, and it moved pale and obscene, like a huge slug pulsing softly as it devoured the swollen ripe fruits of the woman's bosom. Beyond the fires, on the far side of the circle of open earth, a group of three Italian soldiers were clustered fearfully, their faces shiny white with sweat and terror in the firelight, and their hands bound behind their backs. They'd been stripped to their breeches, and the exposed skin of their backs and arms was welted and bruised where they'd been beaten and abused. Their naked feet were swollen and bloody. Clearly, they'd been forced to march thus for long distances across the harsh, stony earth. Their dark eyes, huge with horror, were fastened on the spectacle that was being enacted on the open stage of bare earth in the limelight of the fires. Vicky recognized the woman as one of Rascula's favourites, whom she'd seen last, that night at the rest house of Sardi. Now she knelt, heavy-breasted and intent on her work. The round Madonna face was alight with an almost religious ecstasy, the full lips parted and the dark, slow eyes glowing like those of a priestess at some mystic rite. However, more prosaically, the sleeves of her shama were drawn up in businesslike fashion above the elbows like those of a butcher, and her hands were bloody to the wrists. She held the thin, curved dagger like a surgeon, and its silver blade was dull and red in the firelight. The thing over which she worked still wriggled and moved convulsively against its bonds, still breathed and sobbed, but it was no longer recognizable as a man. The knife had stripped away all resemblance, and now, as the waiting crowd growled and swayed and sighed, the woman worked doggedly at the base of the disemboweled belly, cutting and tugging, so that the victim screamed again, but feebly, and the woman leapt to her feet and held aloft the mutilated handful she'd cut free. She did a triumphant circuit of the arena, holding her prize high, laughing, dancing, on shuffling, swaying feet, and the blood trickled down her raised forearm and dripped from the crook of her elbow. "Stay close," Jake said softly, but Vicky had never heard that tone in his voice before. She tore her horrified gaze from the spectacle and saw that his face was stern and drawn, his jaw clenched hard and his eyes terrible. He drew the pistol from his pocket and held it against his thigh, his arm hanging loosely at his side as he moved swiftly, thrusting his way through the press of bodies with such strength that he cleared a path for her to follow him. Every single gala was concentrating with all his attention on the dancing woman, and Jake reached Rascala before any of them realized his presence. Jake took the soft, thick upper arm in his left hand, his fingers digging deeply into the putty's soft flesh, and he jerked him to his feet and held him, dangling off balance, swinging him face to face, and he pressed the muzzle of the Beretta into his upper lip, just under the wide nostrils. They stared at each other, Rascula cringing away from Jake's blazing eyes, and then whimpering at the pain of the fingers, cutting into his flesh, and fear of the steel muzzle bruising his upper lip. Jake assembled a few words of Amalek he'd learned from Gregorius. "The Italians," he said softly. "From me." Rascula stared at him, seeming not to hear. Then he said one word, and the men nearest them swayed forward, as though to intervene. Jake screwed the muzzle of the pistol into Rascula's lip, twisting and smearing the soft flesh against his teeth, so that the skin tore and blood sprang swiftly. "You die," said Jake, and the man shrilled the denial to his warriors. They drew back reluctantly, fingering their knives and watching with smouldering eyes for their opportunity. The woman with the bloody hands sank to her haunches, And a great waiting silence gripped the assembly. They squatted in complete silence, all their faces turned towards Jake and Ras Kula. In the silence, the broken, bleeding thing beside the fire cried out again, a long, drawn-out, breathy sound that tore at Jake's nerves and made his expression ferocious.
"Tell your men," he said,
his voice thick and grating with his anger. Ras Kula's voice quavered, high as a young girl, and the warriors who guarded the three half-naked prisoners shuffled uncertainly and exchanged glances. Jake ground the steel fiercely into the Ras Kula's face, and his voice squeaked urgently as he repeated the order. Reluctantly, the guards prodded the prisoners forward in a forlorn, terrified group.
"Take his dagger,"
Jake said quietly to Vicky, without removing his gaze from Ras Kula's eyes. Vicky stepped close beside the Ras and gripped the hilt of the weapon on the embroidered belt around his sagging paunch. It was worked in beaten gold and set with crudely cut amethyst, but the blade was brilliant and the edge keen.
"Cut them loose," said Jake.
And in the dangerous moments, when she was away from his side, he increased the brutal pressure on the pistol barrel. Ras Kula stood with his head cocked at an impossible angle, his lips drawn back from his teeth in a fixed snarl, and his eyes rolling in their sockets until the whites showed, and the tears of pain poured freely down his cheeks, glinting in the firelight like dew on the yellow petals of a rose. Vicky cut the rawhide bindings at the Italian's wrists and elbows, and they massaged the circulation back into their arms. Huddling together, their pale faces still smeared with dirt and dried blood, and their eyes terrified and uncomprehending. Quickly, Vicky crossed back to Jake and stood close beside him. Somehow there was safety and security when she was near to him. She stayed beside him as Jake forced Ras Kula step by step across the open ground to where the maimed, half-destroyed thing still moved weakly and drew each agonized breath of air with a bubbling sigh. Jake stooped slightly away from Ras Kula, but still holding him, and Vicky saw the comparison after the fierce expression in his eyes for a moment. She didn't realize what he was going to do until he dropped the pistol from Ras Kula's face and extended his arm at full stretch. The crack of the pistol was sharp and cutting in the stillness, and the bullet hit the mutilated Italian in the center of his forehead, leaving a dark blue hole in the gleaming white skin of his brow. The eyelids fluttered like the wings of a dying dove, and the arched, straining body sagged and relaxed. A long, gusty sigh came up the tortured throat, the sigh a man might make at the very edge of sleep, and then he was still. Without another look at the man, to whom he'd given peace, Jake lifted the pistol to Ras Kula's face again, and with fresh pressure on his arm, he forced him to turn and walk slowly back. With a curt inclination of the head, he signaled the three Italians to move. They went first, moving slowly, still shrinking together. Then Vicky followed them, one hand for comfort, reaching back to touch Jake's shoulder. Jake held Ras Kula's twisted off balance and forced him step by step onwards. He knew they mustn't hurry, they mustn't show weakness, for the flimsy bonds which held the gallows frozen would snap at the least strain, and they'd be soon upon them, in a pack, bearing down under the press of bodies and hacking and tearing them to pieces.